My friend came to me, sadness in his eyes, told me that he wanted help for his country.
Those impassioned words in 1971, George Harrison galvanized an already activist rock community to put their money where their mouths were. The concert for Bangladesh would raise $250,000 for an area of the world that I think it's fair to say nobody knew about just a few months beforehand.
Never seen such distress.
Can rock music save the world? For its fifth anniversary issue, Paste Magazine asked that question and put together a feature that's thought-provoking and it's insightful. Today, on All Songs Considered, we address rock music's more generous side. We have in our studios in Atlanta the editor and chief of Paste Magazine, Josh Jackson. He joined us from member station WABE in Atlanta. Good day, Josh.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for doing this. In London, we have Kevin Wall. Kevin Wall is the founder of Live Earth. It's the event that unfolds across the globe to raise environmental awareness about climate change. Kevin Wall, greetings.
Good evening.
Thank you. And in Austin, Texas, we have Alejandro Escovedo. Alejandro, you know, is a great musician. He's a singer, he's a songwriter, and has some personal stories to tell us as well. Greetings, Alejandro. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. Great. How are you?
I'm fine. So, good. Most rock musicians don't get started playing their music in the hopes of either raising awareness or raising money for a cause. Kevin Wallace, is this a okay marriage? I mean, does it work?
I think it works, you know, fantastically well. You know, you played the George Harrison song, but we can go a little later to the apartheid movement, a movement that was sort of a fringe college-only movement until the music industry, you know, played a song, I Won't Play Sun City, that resulted in a massive concert that I was involved in London.
What year is this, Kev?
This was in 88, and within 1 year, a guy who had been in prison 25 years, who there hadn't been a photo of, Nelson Mandela, yeah, was released from prison. And this is where, you know, music with a message gained global awareness, pressure was put on to stop buying goods of companies that manufactured there. It changed the entire governmental system. And I think there's a lot of instances of that on a global basis for the past 25 years.
We had one of our writers who's been writing about rock and roll for, you know, 30-something years has been asking people all these kinds of questions of what the role of rock and roll is and changing the world. And he says, you know, looking back as he's looking over, talking to all these different people, that there was almost a seismic shift before Live Aid and after Live Aid. Before Live Aid, everybody talked about the power of words and the power of music. And after Live Aid, people saw that it could be a much more concrete thing of people coming together for a specific cause and just the amount of aid that was raised from Live Aid and the actual difference that it made with over $200 million for famine relief. It changed people's perspective on what could actually be accomplished.
Alejandro, you were in bands going back to the early 70s, maybe you know, a few years past Bangladesh and a few years past 1971. What was it like for you being in a band back then?
We were basically revolting against what we were hearing on the radio, and that was our initial inspiration for starting bands, was just to play the kind of music that we were not hearing on the radio. But that led to a lot of punk rock really brought attention to a lot of different things, rock against racism. We were doing benefits in San Francisco for the miners in Kentucky. Huh. We were doing all kinds of benefits that were socially oriented, you know. So, I mean, there was quite an awareness there, and that was part of it. But I must say that when I first began, it was really about kind of learning how to play those three chords, really were more intense than anything else, you know.
Kim, well, your life was sort of deeply embedded in the 70s in that way pre-Live Aid. You supplied staging, is that right, for Led Zeppelin, for George Harrison, for the Rolling Stones? Your life is sort of part of that wretched excess that rock has, and that attracts so many people sort of to rock and roll, but also repels so many people from the music scene. But you turned your life around. How did that happen?
The big influence early in my life, when I was 18, as part of the Rainbow People's Party in Michigan.
And remind people what the Rainbow People's Party in
that was sort of, that was at the time one of the political movements in Ann Arbor. And John Sinclair, who was the founder, was put into prison for two joints of marijuana for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And the concert was done to raise money and to help the cause, and John Lennon and Yoko decided to come and play. And the political pressure was so huge that this was looked at, and John Sinclair was let out of prison 30 days later on appeal. That changed my life. That was in like 71. There's a movie about it now called The U.S. versus John Lennon. It was about what happened post that with the U.S. government and John Lennon. But from that, I started doing tours with the Stones and Led Zeppelin and a lot of major bands, building their stages, doing their lighting and sound. And in the mid-80s or the early 80s, I went through a 12-step program and left the business momentarily. And when I came back, it was about giving back. And that was about the time that USA for Africa happened, We Are the World. Mm-hmm. And I did the media, the global distribution for that. And I got involved in the television, helping architect and put together television deals on the original Live Aid. So I've always, you know, leaned toward these things whenever I could lend my time and affect change through music. And I've been very fortunate to be involved in some good causes with some great people.
Two things that you've said that struck me that I'd love to see if you can help make tactile and tangible for me. You said that, you know, John Lennon comes and plays a benefit and there's pressure put on and the guy's released in 30 days. Who would care? The connection between the John Lennon playing a benefit and whatever government or local official feels like this is a lot of pressure and I better let this guy out. I mean, who feels that pressure? Why would they care about some rock musician? How does that work?
Because it created a press event. It created a monumental event because of the size of the stars on that day. And on that day, media was really influenced by everything around the event. And politicians react to that. Consumers react to that. They vote to that. And if you've seen the movie, The U.S. versus John Lennon, the movie is really about the amount of pressure they put on it. Now, Live Earth is similar in a lot of ways. It's taking awareness and trying to move people from awareness to a behavioral change. It's trying to create awareness with people that are still skeptical. And if we can empower people with just the smallest behavioral change, let's say changing a light bulb, they will start to defend their new actions to their friends, to their office workers, and they will buy green, and eventually they will vote green. So this is the launch of a very aggressive global campaign to really try to make a change on a global basis, not just in the United States, not just in the UK where I am today, but everywhere around the globe. And it's a complicated, tough thing to do, and we don't think one show solves the problem. This will take several years. This is the launch of a several-year campaign.
For Live Earth, well, I want to talk about the consciousness of raising because, Kevin, you've taken this, what on the face of it seems kind of odd. I mean, there's a chance here to make some money and put money towards a cause, no? But Live Earth isn't doing that, right?
No, what Live Earth is doing, it's using media to affect change. If you think about it, on the original Live Aid, we raised $200 million. And that $200 million was spent very immediately buying food and shipping it to Africa to take care of the problem, the immediate problem. But the long-term problem, that problem came back because it was a much more complicated long-term problem. The second project, Live 8, we used the pressure point and media awareness to get 8 men to forgive $50 billion in debt.
Yeah.
And they did. So Live Earth, what it's about is using awareness, using media to make a change. We announced a 7-point plan last week with Al Gore, a 2-year negotiation.
Can you tell us the
7?
I mean, can you sort of
summarize? Well, I don't have the full 7 points
Fine,
in front of me, but I could tell you three key points.
Okay, good.
One is a 90% reduction in the carbon levels by 2050, the carbon levels that were established in 1990. Two, a 2-year negotiation to replace the Kyoto Treaty. By 2009, the negotiation finished. By 2010, put into full effect. That's 2 years earlier than it currently is on the table, and the next negotiation comes up in December in Bali. And number three, an immediate moratorium on coal-fed energy plants. These are very aggressive goals, but these are pledges that we're asking people all over the world to sign, along with personal pledges that they make changing their own carbon footprint and their own carbon lifestyle.
So tell me how it works. The concert is Friday. People connect to the concert in whatever way. Is it cable TV or internet or whatever? And how do they know about these goals? How do you get your message out about what sort of changes Live Earth would like to have?
On this day, we will connect with about 2 billion people.
My goodness.
We're on television in 119 countries. We're on radio in 124 countries. We're on wireless devices in about 50 countries, and we're on broadband in 42 countries, which is, you know, the internet, in 21 different languages. This is the deepest media penetration in the history of an event. It surpasses the Olympics or the Super Bowl, and all of this to try to get messaging across. Now, if we can take music and we can transfer that emotion that you get from music, that emotion that tugs our heart, and put it with a message, we will create the same idea, the same feeling that you would have had hearing Blowing in the Wind around the Civil Rights Movement, or, you know, Eric Clapton's song, Tears from Heaven. When you can attach it to a message, it becomes very, very powerful. Each one of these artists, when they're playing on these different stages, on the 9 stages around the world, behind them are messaging, and in between their acts...
What do you mean by that?
When they're playing on the stage, on big screens behind them, in the local language, is messaging about the environment, about global warming, and about solution-based programming. During set changes, we've made 60 short movies that have been made by different directors around the world in different languages and cultures, animation and drama and et cetera. Some are Academy Award filmmakers that will play those films in between the set changes as we're making set changes around the globe. We've also created 30 new PSAs that are in 22 different languages by people like Cameron Diaz and Will Ferrell. You'll start to see those across the networks this week. And we've created a book, which is a companion guide that's coming out, that's on sale last week. It went on sale last week at Borders and Amazon, et cetera. So it's been a very complex project. We've started to do coaching with artists on greening. So we've had scientists set with artists. We've created artist manuals about how they're living their lifestyle.
Well, that's what I was thinking about, if I can interrupt just a minute, because you think about all of the, I mean, what does it take to get all of these people in, all the jet planes they've got to fly and all the bottled water they're going to drink and all that stuff that, so how do you get these green artists to be greener?
Well, so what this project is about, it's about what you do, the commitment you make today going forward. It's really not about what you've done in the past. I've 6 months now, you know, I've really entered the modern environmental movement. And I've changed the lighting in my house. I've changed the cars that I've driven. I've changed the way that I travel. Artists are always going to tour. Football games are going to continue to happen. That's not going to stop as a result of this. But what's happening is we're getting artists to commit going forward, different types of fuel to transport their trucks, new lighting systems that are LED that use, you know, a half or 10% of the energy, smaller tour footprints, carbon offsetting of their tours. We're also working with artists, and we're putting them one-on-one with scientists to talk about, you know, the issue and our messaging and how in their own personal life they can make changes. So a lot of these artists, when we book this show, these shows are booked with artists that are touring right now, that are on the road, so we're not changing the way that they're traveling to do our shows. And in the cases where artists are coming out to do this especially for us, like Madonna or Bon Jovi in New York, we didn't ask Madonna to go from London to New York to do the show. She's doing the show in London. Bon Jovi's doing it in New York. So we were very conscious about the carbon footprint and trying to minimize it as much as possible. But in the end, there are over 3,000 concerts that happen a year. This is 9 concerts. And with those 9 concerts, we will touch that day 2 billion people. And if you think about it, Al Gore gave this slideshow for 30 years. In the last 5 years, he's given it to thousands of people live. And 2 people in Hollywood saw it and made it a movie. And that movie, which is now a DVD, a few million people have seen it. And it's affected a lot of people, and it's had a lot of change positively about this issue. This issue has gone from page 6 to page 1 today. Next Saturday, or this coming Saturday, we're going to touch 2 billion people. We're giving Al Gore the microphone, and now we're going to go to the next step, because this is a global problem. This is not the air that we breathe in Indiana is the same air they breathe in London and the same air they breathe in China. This is about global citizenry, and this is about a humanitarian crisis that's happening now. And these artists that are coming out to play are going to play passionately, and we're going to try to really create a tipping point for the beginning of a change about humanity.
Before I let you go, is there any song that's galvanizing any of this? Have any artists come up with anything for Live Earth?
Yeah, Madonna wrote a song called Hey You, which is one of the key songs she's playing. Will I Am of the Black Eyed Peas has written a fabulous song that he's premiering that day, and it's unbelievable. And then we have a real surprise of an artist that all of you on this phone call would love, who's doing a song that really was one of the first environmental songs ever written, doing it live. And that's a surprise. So on Saturday, turn on television, listen to the radio at the beach, go online and watch it, join us, join our pledge, make a change. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin Wall.
Lord, come down and help us out. Send us an angel, help us out. SOS, help us out. I'm looking all around and I'm watching the world.
People killing, people dying, people lying, people blind, people don't see the sign, watching money all the time, get the pennies, get the dimes, get the dollars is the mind, state of the human race, people on a paper chase, the environment is fragile, and we've been on the gradual, declining in a lifetime, we'll lose the battle, get burned by volcanoes, get blown by tornadoes, cause Mother Nature signals, is trying to warn NATO.
Josh Jackson and Alejandro Escovedo, have you seen rock make an effective change? Alejandro.
I've seen it make a change in people's lives, you know. I look at my life, I was this kid, grew up in San Antonio in 51, Mexican kid, moved to California. I don't know, it took me from a place in which I was pretty much marked for a life of being a laborer, you know. And it took me away from that. It took me open my eyes to a much larger community of people. I think rock and roll has very much changed the complex of the world in a sense, you know.
And Josh?
Yeah, I totally agree. Just from the music itself and the impact it can have on people and any kind of beauty and poetry and so a thing that you become passionate about, it can bring you focus and just bring you joy. But beyond that, I think rock musicians, individuals, regardless of the fact that they're rock musicians, but since they are, they're using their gifts and their talents and their platform to really try to make a difference in people's lives. You look at somebody like Steve Earle, who, you know, has a passion for death row inmates and for abolishing the death penalty, and how he's using that through his songs and through his writings and his actions, trying to, you know, bring about that kind of change.
What the song Steve Earle wrote was
Ellis Unit 1.
Let's give a listen to that and then come back and talk about affecting change with music.
was fresh out of the service. It was back in 82. And I raised some cane when I come back to town. I left to be all I could be, come home without a clue. And I married Dawn and had to settle down. Hired on at the prison, guess I always knew I would. Just like my dad and both my uncles done. And I've worked on every cell block now, and things are going good. But then they transferred me to LS Unit 1.
There was something that I just, you know, was staggering to me, this issue of slavery that was in the Pace magazine article, which is really, for those who haven't read the article, it's a fantastic article. You should spend some time with it. But tell us about the notion of slavery in what, you know.
Yeah, this is something that I think hit me most personally working on this issue, was just learning that there's a book, Not for Sale, by David Batstone, and I read the book and was reading, you know, I was aware that there were child soldiers in Uganda, and I was aware that there were child prostitutes in Southeast Asia and forced labor in Dominican Republic and places like that. I knew all those things, but I had no idea that there's 27 million slaves in the world today. That's more than any other time in history, more than back in the, you know, before the 1860s, before abolition in this country.
So maybe expands the definition of what we might think of as a slave, but still, it's easy to understand how defining it as a slave is certainly the right thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, slavery is outlawed in every country on this earth, but because it's not government sanctioned doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And so kind of getting my head around this issue, and there's an upcoming concert, well, an upcoming series of film performances that'll be released on DVD called The Concert to End Slavery, which will be out later this year, that T-Bone Burnett is very involved with, and singer-songwriter by the name of Justin Dillon, and they've gotten, you know, involvement with people like Cold War Kids and Moby and all kinds of folks. So we're also going to be putting out a benefit CD later this year with Live from Pace, when we've had people come and play in our office or at our events. And so it'll be all the proceeds will be going to the Not for Sale campaign.
Now, Alejandro, your story is so different than, you know, ending slavery, and it's not and ending world poverty or ending, trying to end AIDS. But it's so deeply affecting and so important. Could you tell that for folks who don't know how, you know, your good karma came back to you, huh?
I guess I got to go back to, you know, I started playing in punk rock bands in 75 and was in a band called The Nuns, which took me to New York. I then played with Judy Nylon there. I was there during the Sid and Nancy, living in the Chelsea when the Sid and Nancy incident happened, and then moved back to Texas, you know, and then started my solo career after the True Believers. And I was touring and making records locally, but touring all across the country, working quite hard. I was diagnosed with hepatitis C in about 96 or 7, I believe it was. I was on Ryko Disc. I had made an album called With These Hands. And I was just working very, very hard behind that. I was in Canada when I was diagnosed. I came back to Texas and found that I indeed had hepatitis C. They didn't call it Hep C then. It was non-A, non-B. Mm-hmm. And basically, my doctor at that time told me what she told her AIDS patients, which was that I should just go out and live the best life I possibly could. And so I went out and was very depressed for a while, but then hit the road again and started working, and was then struck with the disease. Really kind of took me down in, I guess it was 2003, where I had internal bleeding in three different areas. I was hospitalized, and I was taken out of the rock and roll game for about 2 years, I guess it was, and kind of faced with, you know, a lot of serious questions about what I was going to do, how I was going to survive, feed my family.
And it's not as if rock and roll musicians often put that money aside and open the start an insurance policy and have health insurance and stuff.
No, it's
you don't
quite
think
the
of
opposite.
That stuff.
It's, no, it's quite the opposite. Yeah. And you know, you have to remember too that, like, on the level that I tour on, it's a matter of really taking every penny that you have and putting it back into, you know, gas and paying the musicians and whatnot and trying to survive on the road. So I was in a pretty desperate place, and then all my manager Heinz Geisler put together or called out for people to maybe do an album, you know, to help me out. And at first it started with all these concerts all over the country. I mean, I can't even remember how many concerts there were. It had to be about 30 of them or so, and then spread to Canada, and there was even a couple in London, I believe. And so through that and this record that was made by my friends and family, it really allowed me to heal, you know.
That must have been, I mean, how do you even express that to
I don't
your
know.
Friends?
It's you know, it's funny, I don't think about it as often as I used to, but in thinking about it now, it's really a pretty amazing thing, you know.
Everybody waves goodbye. Climb aboard the train. Turn with my again.
There is this fun now that your story is early on in this, but there's something called Sweet Relief. I don't recall if this is part of Sweet Relief, your the double record set of people doing your songs. And name some of these artists who helped you out, because, you know.
Yeah, this is a post Sweet Relief. This was really independent of that, and the kind of people that were helping me out were the Jayhawks, Lucinda Williams, Steve Earle, Sun Volt, Ian Hunter, John Cale, Jennifer Warnes, Ian McLagan,
yeah.
Los Lonely Boys, my brother Javier, my brother's younger brother's band, The Dragons, my older brother Pete and his daughter Sheila E. The list just went on and on. Nick Tremulous from Chicago, M. Ward, and you know, Vic Chestnut and Hal Gelb, and I mean, we could have made a box set by all the people who really wanted to play on it. So it was really a special, special thing for me.
And did it make the difference for you?
It made a huge difference in many ways. I mean, not just obviously financially, it allowed me to survive those years in which I was taking this medicine called interferon. And it was quite devastating, that medicine. So it allowed me to survive that. And I think spiritually and psychologically, it finally inspired me to want to go on and play myself, you know.
Great story. Thank you so much, both of you. Josh Jackson, the editor-in-chief of Pace Magazine. Thanks, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
Alejandra Escovedo, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Yeah. Thank you.
Be well.
All right, you too, man.
Take care.
I'll see you, Josh.
All right, see you, Alejandra.
Thanks to Josh Jackson, thanks to Kevin Wall and Alejandro Escovedo. You can see a link to the Paste article on our website, npr.org. Our producers, Robin Hilton, Marty Curtis did the engineering. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
The king's taken back the throne. The useless sing the song. When they say they're cutting off the throne,
a time you're not home. No place to hide. You're fighting as a soldier on the side. You're still a soldier in your mind, though nothing's on the line. Say it's money that we need, as if we're only mouths to feed. I know no matter what you say, there's some debts you'll never pay. Working for the church while your family dies. You take what they give you and you keep it inside. Every spark of friendship and love will die without a home. Hear the soldier groan, go at it alone. I can taste the fear. Lift me up and take me out of here. Don't wanna fight, don't wanna die, just wanna hear you cry. Who's gonna throw the very first stone?